Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It's Monday afternoon, March 27th, 2017, and we have a very full agenda today, and we're going to do some good work. Senator Bertscher won't be here today. He can't be here today. And Senators Przanski and Roblin are off. They're busy bees pollinating other committees right now, but they will be back, and we'll have their participation. Given that, so just my intention for today is to start with Senate Bill 995. That's the materials balancing bill, and that's because we have the fewest people signed up for that one. And then we'll have a work session on Senate Bill 3. I assume we'll be at full complement by then. That's the suction dredge mining bill. And that bill, we're having a work session in order to adopt the Dash 8 amendments to that bill. And then we will combine our public hearings on Senate Bills 928 and 929, both of which have to do with neonicotinoids. So with that, I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 995. Beth, can you tell us what this bill does, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 995 would require an employer to submit an annual materials balance report to the Department of Environmental Quality showing the weight in pounds of each facility's input and output of hazardous substances. There is no subsequent referral, and that's all I know right now. You need to go get Senator Riley.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to start with the others?
Yes. Let's just stand. Okay, we're back in order. Senator Riley, welcome. Tell us about your bill.
Well,
and if you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, absolutely. My name is Chuck Riley. I'm state senator for District 15, Hillsborough, Corneas, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy, Verbort, and some farms. And this is a bill that was brought to me by some folks who are very concerned about toxic chemicals in the environment. And this bill would very simply require businesses who already know what chemicals they have coming in, toxic chemicals they have coming in, to let us know where they go. And there are four places that toxic chemicals can go once they've come in to a business. And those are out in a product, out into the air, out in water, or out into the ground. And we simply want them to let us know where those toxic chemicals are going when they leave their business.
Okay. Senator Olson, you have any questions?
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. In reading the bill, it states that they need to show where the facility's input and output are.
Right.
So are you assuming that in product construction, because you stated out in product, is the manufacturer to assume that all of their hazardous material goes into the product, and so they would just state that it's a product-related outflow?
If it all does go into the product, that's not really the case in all situations. It could be that the chemicals are used in a process and then go out in wastewater or are... for instance, in a spraying situation, they might go out in the air, and in which case they'd need filters, air filters, and so on. Or they could be caught in a filter. But they need to tell us, you know, where those chemicals end up after they are through with them. And as I say, they could go out in the product or out in the air or in wastewater or actually just be put into a dump.
Follow up.
It says here on line 22 that they must indicate the weight in pounds of the facility's input and output to the closest or smallest accounting unit. How are they supposed to account for that?
Well, they already know what chemicals come in. They know where they go. All they need to do is tell us.
That didn't quite answer the question. Follow up. I'm sorry.
Sure.
That didn't quite answer the question. How are they supposed to know? Because they said that they have to, the weight and pounds input and output has to balance. So how could they assume that some might go out in the production in a water flow or an air flow? How could they? Yeah. Are they supposed to provide measurement equipment to measure all of that stuff?
Hopefully they know this already. If not, then this, yes, absolutely. They need to be able to balance the input and output so we know that the chemicals that came in went out somewhere, and we need to know where and in what percentages. So,
thank you.
Yes, thank you. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more.
Sure, absolutely. There will be other people answering your questions better than I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks for bringing this bill before us. So our first panel, and I'm just going to call these up in the order in which people signed up, and alternating between those who are proponents of the bill and those who are opponents of the bill. So Andy Harris, Micah Mesko, and Catherine Salzman, please.
This is the shortest list.
Shorter.
Which bill are we on?
995.
You want to start, please?
Yeah. Sure.
Chairman Denbrough and members of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, my name is Andy Harris. I live in North Portland, and I'm testifying for SB 995 on behalf of Oregon Center for Christian Voices and also for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. The heavy metals, lead, chromium, arsenic, nickel, cadmium, and cobalt, have been identified in Portland near point sources, such as Bullseye Glass and Precision Cast Parts Corporation. The release of toxics from Portland manufacturing firms underscores the need to monitor full materials balanced reporting of toxic chemicals. As a physician, I know that even minute amounts of toxic chemicals can cause serious and permanent damage to developing brains and endocrine and immune systems in infants and young children. Many toxic chemicals readily cross the placenta and can damage a fetus at critical stages of development. Low-income people and communities of color have the highest health risks from industrial air pollution because they are more likely to live in close proximity to manufacturing plants. State agencies and local communities have an obligation to know what toxics are being discharged into the air, ground, water, and waste. Every major religion calls on its followers to care for the most vulnerable among us. Oregon Center for Christian Voices speaks for the poor, hungry, elderly, homeless, but also those who are most impacted by pollution. For example, children and people living near industrial pollution. The irony is that people who are most affected cannot hire lobbyists and seldom get to voice their concerns. Particularly at a time of drastic EPA budget cuts, states must do everything possible to monitor and regulate toxic pollutants. Jeremiah chapter 2:7 reads, "And I brought you to a beautiful land to enjoy its fruits and good things. But when you came in, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination." In this day and age, and with the resources we have available, we can do a whole lot better. So let's not gamble on our children's health. Senate Bill 995 would provide a database of toxic chemicals so that DEQ can zero in on potential toxic emission sources. I urge you to support Senate Bill 995. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Micah?
Good afternoon. My name is Micah Meskel, and I'm with the Audubon Society of Portland. Thank you, Chair Denbrough and committee members. We are here. I'm presenting on behalf of our 17,000 members statewide, and we would like to show support for SB 995. I'll be very brief, but we think it's a common sense approach to accounting of hazardous materials, both for the state and the public to be aware of the hazardous emissions in their community. And we'd like to show our support also for Chuck Riley in sponsoring this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dembrow, members of the committee, for your attention to this really important bill. My name is Catherine Salzman. I have lived in Southeast Portland for 35 years, and I'm a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition. EPAC works in partnership with neighborhood groups across the state who have been affected by toxic air pollution. I'm also serving as alternate on the Governor's Cleaner Air Oregon Advisory Committee. Accurate data is the background of sound regulatory and public health policy. When state agencies don't have a clear picture of the hazardous chemicals citizens are being exposed to, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to make meaningful policies that will result in meaningful protections. The crisis of heavy metals exposure with the Art Glass facilities revealed how unaware DEQ is of the processes at the facilities it regulates and how unprepared Oregon Health Authority is to deal with an environmental crisis, an environmental health crisis. Policies and actions based on full materials balancing would establish a strong, realistic foundation for informed and decisive action. Experts who served on the Cleaner Air Oregon's technical advisory work group were very clear that accurate data is essential for accurate risk assessment and meaningful regulation. Cleaner Air Oregon is a great long overdue start to correcting some of the regulatory imbalances and oversights, but is very narrow in scope. It's stationary air toxics only, and doesn't account for the entirety of what people are actually exposed to. Senate Bill 995 would give our underfunded DEQ a cost-effective tool for assessing public health risks from industrial toxins. For example, stack testing, which is referred to as the gold standard for accurate air emissions data, and fence line monitoring are both very expensive. Full materials balancing reports, like a more accurate and comprehensive version of the now famous Moss study, would enable the DEQ to identify toxic hotspots and prioritize deployment of expensive monitoring, testing, and enforcement resources, or to catch a potential problem before it becomes a public health crisis. This is a matter of accountability and an opportunity for businesses and regulators to get up to speed on industrial processes and hazardous chemicals in the environment. This will allow our public health officials to have a comprehensive picture of the toxic burden their communities are facing, and for DEQ to write permits that adequately protect public health and the health of the environment. Please pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine. Any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony. Okay, next, Heath Curtis, Catherine Van Natta, and Lana Butterfield, please. Anyone here? Oh.
There's a big group outside.
Okay. Heath, yeah. There's Lana. Okay, great. And Heath and Lena can get started. Heath, weren't you here just last week?
I was.
I was. As were you, Chuck.
A frequent flyer.
Chair Dembrow, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We're here testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 995. I was in the hall listening to the testimony that was delivered moments ago, and I'm not entirely certain it was testimony on the same bill that I'm reading. This bill would require mass balance accounting that's true through EPA, but I don't see anything necessarily about stack testing or fence line monitoring. I suppose that's one way you could get at the challenge. So what we have in Oregon today is a community right to know statute, and that statute's at ORS 453.307. And that statute allows local communities to implement toxics reporting programs, and it's very flexible. It doesn't actually give a lot of specifics about what should be included and how you would do that reporting. What this bill does, to the contrary, is it mandates that very specific entities, and very specific substances be reported, and that they do them such that the facility's input and output of hazardous substances are equal. And it talks about reporting down to the smallest accounting unit. That sounds to me like a term of art, but it's actually nowhere defined in the bill, in this single page. Our position is that there's plenty of opportunity to get information about toxics today. Businesses are already reporting thousands of chemicals through their air, water, and hazardous waste permits, and through EPCRA, the Federal Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. On top of all of this information, local communities can elect to impose community right to know ordinances under ORS 453.307. That seems to me to be a pretty good solution. This here mandates that this reporting will be conducted through DEQ. Make no mistake, this will be a large and very expensive undertaking, both for reporters, employers as defined under the statute, and for the agency. We think it's duplicative and unnecessary, and for those communities that want this information, they can pursue it using existing statutory authority. So for those reasons, OFIC urges your no vote on Senate Bill 995.
Thank you very much, Heath. Lana.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm also here to oppose Senate Bill 995. I spent some time with the fire marshal who regulates the community right to know last week, and she said that indeed propane may be encompassed under this bill. Our fuel is not an air, ground, or water contaminant. Contaminants are the intended focus of this bill, however, but propane as a clean fuel is designated by the federal government. Furthermore, in the event of an unintended release, and regardless of if a propane tank is underground, propane will release and dissipate into the atmosphere as a gas and not contaminate the air. Propane's boiling point is minus 44 degrees Fahrenheit. Thus, while it is stored as a liquid, it immediately turns to vapor and dissipates when propane comes into contact with air. This means propane can never contaminate the air and cannot contaminate the water or ground, as it is never a liquid outside its storage tank. We have been faithfully reporting under the community right to know. We don't want to have to report duplicative to two agencies. And, you know, propane is used to heat your house and cook your food and drive your car. It's not used as, you know, it's not a heavy metal. We ask you to please narrow the focus of this bill if you plan to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lana. Catherine.
For the record, Catherine Venata, Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. Today we are here to oppose Senate Bill 995 for various reasons, but let's start with the definition of employer. The definition of employer relates to a settlement in a lawsuit from 1976. I had to get a lawyer to go look at that settlement to see which NAICS codes were covered to find that pulp and paper was covered. I think that that is a not an appropriate way to draft Oregon legislation, where someone cannot find without consulting and looking up in legal documents whether they're regulated or not. And then also, it's broad because the second part of the definition is that any person operating a facility designated by DEQ. Obviously, that points to DEQ rule writing, and this bill allows for the collection of data, which means that there's probably going to be a fee associated with this. So we're trying to grasp the size of this program. We believe the size of this program would be quite large. So let's talk about what we would report. We would report a hazardous substance, and we have three definitions. And while we don't use any radioactive waste, I'm happy to report we're in the process of making paper. A substance that has an MSDS that relates to yet another program that's not defined in the bill. So once again, it's difficult to determine who would be regulated by this. And then any substance designated hazardous by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Now, the last I checked, our Department of Consumer and Business Services was not in the business of defining hazardous substances necessarily for reporting to the Department of Environmental Quality. So I'm concerned about the circular nature of the definitions and the process that this bill would create. But then let's talk about the annual materials balance report shall be to the smallest accounting unit. A smallest accounting unit not being defined, smallest accounting unit could mean many things, probably to be defined in a large rulemaking, but I'm concerned, would that be a pound? Would that be an ounce? Would that be a nanogram? Would it be parts per quadrillion? Since we don't know, I think that the size of this program, as purported in the bill at the moment, is immense, and I would ask that you take a close look at it and try to decide what the intent is, the problem that we're trying to solve in Oregon that we don't already have the information to solve. And then my final point is, once we do all this reporting, what is the DEQ going to do with that information? Is it going to sit on the shelf? Is it going to do something else? Is it going to roll into another program? So I would ask the committee members to think about these policy questions as you decide whether this bill has merit for passing this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Colleagues, any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, let's have Laura Berg, Lisa Arkin, and Lorianne Bird. Lori, do you want to start? Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Berg, and I live in Milwaukee, and I live close enough to Precision Cast Parts to hear their blowers come on at night. And I've spent many hours lying awake listening to those blowers and wondering exactly what kind of chemicals are coming out of those smokestacks, and is that what's at least partially responsible for the number of cancers that I see in the neighbors right around me. I also live near Eastside Plating, which uses nickel, chromium, and cadmium, all of which are toxic. I don't know what other toxic substances they're using or how much, and that's part of what this bill would address. McClure Industries is also close to my home. I can smell the styrene that they emit. In 2009, McClure put out over 25,000 pounds of styrene, and they have the potential, per their permit, to my understanding, to emit 34 tons of it per year. Right now, I have no way of finding out exactly how much styrene or what other chemicals they're emitting into the air, and neither does DEQ, to my understanding. Full materials balance reporting is critical information that DEQ needs to do their job. Styrene is toxic to the gastrointestinal tract, the kidneys, and the respiratory system. And I wonder if the asthma that I've developed in the last 9 years of living in this neighborhood is partially attributable to the styrene that I've been breathing day in and day out. All we're asking in Senate Bill 99 is for industry to be good neighbors. Whatever they're emitting, we're all breathing, we're all being affected by. And it's only with accurate information that DEQ can make the wise decisions for our environment. And the only piece I would add is from House Bill 2669 is to add that community accessible website so we can all find out what's in the air around us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. Lisa, Laura, who?
Hi, I actually had the intent of testifying on
the neonicotinoids.
Yeah.
Yeah, you signed up for that one as well.
Yes, so that was a mistake. So I apologize, but I will say that.
But you have to give us your name.
I'll say very
first.
Briefly, Lori Ann Bird, Center for Biological Diversity, and a resident of Northeast Portland, and I do support this bill. I've seen many, many issues with air quality in my neighborhood, and a lot of people get sick. So on behalf of myself, the center, and our thousands of Oregon members, I am here to support this bill as well.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you very much for holding this hearing on Senate Bill 995. This bill provides Oregonians with an opportunity to improve health. My name is Lisa Arkin. I represent Beyond Toxics, the statewide environmental health association, and I'm an appointed member of the Governor's Cleaner Air Oregon Policy Advisory Committee, and also serve as the chair of the Eugene Toxics Board. I'd like to briefly discuss Oregon's history on toxic emissions reporting and then describe the benefits of Senate Bill 995. And I want to thank Senator Riley for bringing this bill forward to you. In 1999, the legislature directed the DEQ to establish a policy advisory group to, and I quote, explore options for enhancing statewide hazardous toxics substance reporting and data collection, close quote, from point source pollution. And that bill is easy to find on the DEQ's website, or that, not the bill, the advisory committee's report. Thus, national and local experts were convened to form the Oregon Toxics Reporting Advisory Group. These experts presented their findings to the 71st legislature in the year 2000. Their final report stressed the need for comprehensive toxics reporting. Sadly, not one of the advisory group's recommendations has been implemented to this date. The state failed to provide the one thing that had been promised to all Oregonians 18 years ago, which is comprehensive, multimedia, and accurate toxics emissions reporting systems that communicate environmental risk. So currently, businesses don't report very many chemicals. In Oregon, they're only required to report on 52 chemicals, and those are estimates, not actual materials balance reporting. Other states collect thousands. Materials balancing can track as many as 1,500 chemicals. And I just want to say it's limited to certain standard industry codes and does not include propane as a reported chemical. As explained in the advisory committee's report, toxics reporting is critical for getting better data quality for agency decision making, including data on air, on water, on land, on waste streams, materials hauled away as waste, and materials entrained in a product. A chemical accounting system called materials balancing reporting was suggested as the most comprehensive assessment of toxic chemicals leaving facilities and entering the environment. And there are software systems to do just that, to help a business track their chemicals, and often businesses are already doing that. Senate Bill 995 is the legislator's opportunity to come through on that promise made 18 years ago. And let's not repeat history by ignoring the 1999 legislative toxics reporting request and allow it to be shelved yet again, this report containing such valuable data. Lack of data created the long delay before air regulators discovered that Bullseye and Uroboros glass companies were polluting local communities in far greater amounts than their pollution permits allowed. In fact, Bullseye had filed a rather meaningless report in 2010 under the Toxics Use and Hazardous Waste Reduction Act because neither the industry themselves or the DEQ were tracking their inputs and outputs. This law, the Hazardous Waste Reduction Act, once touted as a landmark law, though well-intentioned, has suffered from absence of funding and lack of industry buy-in. So we urge you, as a promise to the Oregon people 18 years ago, please take action now and support Senate Bill 995. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Questions, colleagues? Lisa, I do have one. We heard from earlier testimony the reference to the community right to know, and you referenced it. What has been your experience with that process, and to what extent can that be an adequate alternative to what's being proposed here.
Mm-hmm. The Community Right to Know Act comes from a federal law called the Emergency Preparedness and Community Response Act, which is authorized by the federal government. It allows local communities to track chemicals in their environment and actually have a way for the public to know about those chemicals. And that system is already used in the city of Eugene and has been in place for already over 20 years, successfully measuring about 1,700 different chemicals, how they're inputted into a process and their fate in the environment. It works very well, and the city has used that data to improve public health outcomes, especially in communities where there's an overburden of pollution. What happened is the bill was amended, or that statute was amended in the late 1990s to kind of create some burdens on cities to enact such a program for themselves. And so it has not gone much farther than the city of Eugene. However, there is great interest in enacting such a thing from other cities in Portland, city of Portland, Multnomah County, because of the problems that have come up where communities realized they couldn't get any data from our state agency, the DEQ, because no data was being tracked. So I don't know if that answers your question, but there is something in place. It's worked for 20 years. Other cities would like to do that. There are burdens on that. And so this bill, Senate Bill 995, differs because it would simply ask the DEQ to do what was requested of them 18 years ago, which is to do materials balancing and better toxics reporting.
And I'm just wondering if the benefit of this version is that it would be a statewide version, you know, as opposed to city by city where there might be different requirements. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's how you envision it.
That's a great question. Thank you, Chair Denbrough. And the industry has complained that they didn't want to see piecemeal legislation, city by city doing it. And yet that's what's happened because there hasn't been funding for the DEQ to actually do toxics reporting. I think that the DEQ would do a great job if they had the resources to do it, because it would help them integrate air, water, and land. All of those programs are under the purview of the DEQ. We are happy to see it at the local government level, of course, if the agency itself was not provided the resources to do it. But we do think a statewide reporting would be efficient.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Our last panel consists of one person. Scott Dahlman, please. Sorry, Scott, I should have brought you up in the earlier panel.
It's all right. This way I don't have to argue over who goes first. Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Dahlman, Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We represent farmers, foresters, and other users of pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. Speaking here today in opposition to Senate Bill 995. Our opposition is because, as drafted and as you've heard from some others, we believe the bill right now is overly broad and could bring in some of our members who we don't think this is intended to include. So the first of those would be distributors of pesticides and fertilizers. They do already report under the Community Right to Know to the State Fire Marshal's Office with the intention of having that information for first responders if they show up to know what's on site. And we support that and support that reporting already happening. But these are not manufacturers. They simply store fertilizer or store pesticides and then deliver them to customers who then use them. So they don't have any emissions per se, but they could still be brought into this and have to do reporting on everything they're bringing in and out, which is an extra paperwork burden. And then we assume some sort of cost would go along with this program for information that we don't think is really valuable. We're even worried that it could bring in some individual farmers and foresters who then purchase those products and at a time might have what would be considered a significant amount, let's say fertilizer. They order fertilizer by the ton, but they order it and then they apply it to the fields. But that might not be for a little while, depending on different weather conditions, and therefore might have to be pulled into this reporting scheme as well. So because of that potential paperwork and cost burden, we urge you not to move Senate Bill 995 forward as written.
Okay. Any questions for Scott? No. Scott, are those your only objections? I mean, if that issue could be clarified, then presumably you would be neutral on it.
Senator Dembro would be happy to talk with you about that, but we believe so.
Great. Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks, Scott. Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 995. We'll have further conversations around it and let you know what's up. What I'm going to do is open the public hearings on the neonicotinoid bills next, and we'll hear our first couple of panels, and then I expect Senator Roblin will be back. We'll do our work session on Senate Bill 3, and then we'll go back to hear further testimony. So I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 928 and Senate Bill 929. And okay, we'll put her up when she comes. Okay. So Dewey Karen, Lori Vollmer, and Brian Lacey, please.
Summary of the bills.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Beth, could you tell us what these bills are?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 928 would require pesticide products and seed containers that contain neonicotinoids to be clearly labeled and deemed food as misbranded if a raw commodity that's the product of soil treated either before or after harvest with neonics unless the container is clearly labeled. Senate Bill 929 would direct the Oregon Department of Agriculture to classify neonics as restricted use pesticides by rule.
Okay, thank you very much, Beth. Okay, Dewey, would you like to go first?
Senator Dembro, members of the panel, particularly Senator Plotansky for his sponsorship of this bill. I'm a retired professor of entomology and wildlife ecology. Moved to Oregon to be.
You move the microphone closer to you. No, you don't have to be on top of it. That's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you catch it? That was captured. Okay. I moved to Oregon with retirement in 2009 to be near the grandkids so I could spoil them after I did such a great job with their fathers. I've taught bees and beekeeping now for 50-plus years, have been a beekeeper myself. I have three colonies in Tygart. I'm a member of District 13. I speak in favor of this. There are several gaps in what we currently are doing with pesticides, particularly the neonicotinoids in Oregon. We had a governor's task force, legislative task force, that met, had a number of recommendations. Some of those recommendations have been already enacted, particularly in testimony that I presented, a written testimony. Senate House Bill 3362 directed development of educational materials and an outreach and education plan outlining the best practices for industry and the general public in the use of pesticides. Additionally, directed development of a safety plan for pesticide applicators that protects honey, bumble, native bees, and other pollinators toward avoiding adverse effects of pesticides on pollinator populations. Some of this developed from the unfortunate kill of bumblebees in a parking lot in Wilsonville due to the illegal spraying of a neonicotinoid. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has enacted some regulation to restrict some use of pesticides, of neonicotinoid pesticides, particularly those that might be applied to linden trees where the incident did occur. Speaking in favor, I would like to point out that I served over 25 years on pesticide applicator training in my previous position in the state of Delaware, and can attest for the effectiveness of this particular type of program. There are a number of hours that are involved, and this does involve the use of restricted use pesticides, so individuals have some additional training. And in that training, we do include training for the aspects of soil, water, and of course, the non-target organisms, such as beneficial insects and our pollinators. this current bill would help fill in the gap. We have an awful lot of information about the negative effects of the neonicotinoids on honeybees, native bees, and other pollinators. It is by no means complete, but we have a good deal of information. And by moving this category of pesticides to restricted use, then we have a better chance to help protect our native pollinators and our honeybees. EPA has inadequate regulations to be able to work with this particular group of pesticides. And so the licensing for these materials does mean that some of these materials are readily available for homeowners, and that's the aspect that this bill would be speaking to try to restrict some of that. I urge you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you. Lori, you want to go next?
Thank you, Senators, for your work on this issue. My name is Lori Vollmer. My partner, Richard Vollmer, and I own and operate a Northeast Portland plant nursery and garden store called Garden Fever. We have 10,000 square foot retail space and a 5,000 square feet interior retail store. We've been in business for 14 years and sell a full range of plants, vegetables, and fruits, annuals, perennial shrubs and trees, and all the products needed to care for them. That's not a commercial. It's just that my hope is the information I present will assist in a decision to prohibit the sale of plant care products containing neonicotinoids to consumers. There is clear scientific evidence that neonicotinoids have a detrimental and, in many cases, lethal effect on pollinators, and the misuse of these products has contributed to the decline of pollinator populations. In the spring of 2013, we removed all plant care items from our retail shelves that contained neonicotinoids and do not use those products to control pests in our nursery. At that time, we also polled the growers we purchased plant material from, and in order to find out how many were using products containing neonicotinoids, and were surprised to learn that many were not. A number of others were working towards eliminating them, many focusing on biocontrol alternatives. And now the majority of our plant growers have eliminated the use of neonicotinoids in their plant care items that they use on their farms. The sales in our plant pharmacy department where these products had lived have increased by 9.4% since the time we removed that product containing them. We've not lost sales in making this change. Instead, we have had healthy increases and the opportunity to continue educating our customers on sustainable garden practices, and it has not been difficult to guide customers in using these different products or methods of pest control because most consumers want to do the right thing, and they look to us to point them in the right direction. Alternative pest control products are the biggest trend for current and future customers. Organic and natural eco-safe products, beneficial insects, and biological controls are the fastest growing category in pest and disease control products. Pollinator gardens are one of the fastest growing trends in the nursery business. It makes no sense to customers to spend time and money planting beautiful gardens that will support bees, birds, native pollinators, and then spread pollinator toxic products on those plants. Pollinator safe products are what consumers want for their gardens, and many ask for them specifically. While it's true that public opinion is trending to use products that are safe for pollinators, it is unclear how long it will take before the reduced sales of these products will result in manufacturers discontinuing their consumer product lines. As I mentioned earlier, consumers rely on retailers to sell products they feel are safe for them to use. As long as these products are on the shelves, some consumers will purchase them. In the meantime, pollinator populations will continue to be affected. Attached to my testimony, I've given you our pictures of the pest control section in our plant pharmacy department. It's small compared to what you see in big box retailers, but it is very effective. When it comes to this category of products, most consumers don't want the biggest selection. They want the best selection of products to meet their needs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Lori. Brian.
Thank you, Senator Dembro. My name is Brian Lacey. I am the owner of an education business called Urban Bees and Gardens. Our mission is to rescue bees, work with children and adults so that they have a accurate, as opposed to perhaps media inflated concept of what bees are, and also to change the landscape with regards to food security, of which pollinators are an integral part. Neonics adversely impact bees' reproduction, ability to navigate, their temperature regulation, impaired learning, and foraging behavior. I have seen this. The people I teach and collaborate with on bees see this as well. Queens that 10 years ago lived 3 to 4 years now only live 1 to 2 years. I'm called dozens of times a year by distraught beekeepers reporting the mysterious death of their hives full of honey, but not one bee in the hive. I read of far more situations identical to this. I often teach about pollinators with kids, how to know a bee from a yellow jacket, that what the television has taught them to fear bees is a lie intended to entertain them through fear, not grounding them in the real world. Most kids are naturally fascinated by the beauty of honeycomb bees' complex communication behaviors. Kids know our survival and health is linked with pollinators. Sometimes I have to check myself from tearing up, looking at their trusting and hopeful faces, knowing that what I know, knowing what I do about how rapidly their rights to secure, healthy future, like bees, are daily being sacrificed to marketing. Today, though, we intend to make one small step, yet significant, chip in this situation to end the retail sale in cities of neonic-based insecticides, poisons today that legally can be applied in far greater concentrations in home gardens than on farms, reportedly at concentrations of up to 120 times as great. We have no idea how many hundreds or thousands of gallons of neonics are applied in neighborhoods. There's no requirement to do so, no funds to study it. Preventing public access to these poisons is vital to halt the exposure risk of bees to bees, pets, and people, especially children. When you turn on the television and you walk into a retailer that sells garden chemicals, colorful marketing promises dispatch of the horrible bugs for a yard that you're proud of that gives great street appeal. So I appeal to you to show that representative government is still alive and well in Oregon by passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, and yes. Since I couldn't bring big signs, which are tucked carefully underneath the chairs, this is a miniature black and white version of what some kids did at a couple of schools.
Great.
Which I will leave with you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any questions, colleagues? I do have a question, Lori. Well, first of all, I have to declare a potential conflict of interest because I live within steps of Garden Fever, and I love your shop. Thank you. Having said that, you know, in terms of the requirement for labeling, mm-hmm. you know, the neonicotinoids, how if there were that kind of requirement, presumably that would help you in deciding what to put on your shelf, but how would it affect your ordering process, you know, as you're ordering products for your store?
Well, I think labeling definitely is an important thing to have on product, and we point out labeling to our customers. However, this product, I think, personally, I believe, is too dangerous to have just labeling on, mainly because of the damage that I think it has already done to pollinator pollinator populations. Thank you.
Three times.
What I find with plant care products, especially, is that with consumers, more is better. And I don't feel, from my experience of 14 years of you know, talking to customers, that they really follow directions religiously. As an example, my husband Richard and I have been coming to work the last few mornings and staring at a neighbor's bed who had bought some sluggo from us. And sluggo is obviously to kill slugs, and it's an iron-based product, and you're supposed to put just a few granules around the plant. And this is a bed of tulips that are all coming up, and literally on one of the tulips, the leaf is leaning over because it's so piled up. I mean, people just, people just don't follow the regulations on those. And so I feel we shouldn't be selling products that have that possibility of doing harm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask Representative Marsh to come up now, please.
While she's coming up, being one of the sponsors, what I'm going to do is waive my time since we have so many people.
Yes.
I have it in writing. We'll post it before the end of the day. But I think we have enough people here that we'd like to hear from.
Thank you very much. Representative Marsh, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee. It is always so much fun to be in a place where there are a bunch of pollinator fans. For the record, I'm Pam Marsh. I'm representative for House District 5, which is the other end of the state, southern Jackson County. My constituents have charged me with the responsibility of protecting the health and well-being of residents, our environment, and our local economy. Accordingly, I am here today to express my strong support as a co-sponsor of Senate Bill 929, the Oregon Pollinator Protection Act. This legislation is critical for Jackson County as well, for the entire state of Oregon. Study after study indicates that neonicotinoids are killing our bees and other pollinators. We have to take action, and we need to do it now. Briefly, OPA will classify neonicotinoids as restricted-use pesticides, meaning only professional, trained, and certified applicators will be able to purchase and use them. These products will remain available to farmers, orchardists, nursery owners, and vintners, people who are trained by our State Department of Agriculture to know how to use the products judiciously and in a way that is safer for pollinators. This bill will restrict the common use of neonicotinoids by the general public. Neonicotinoids, or neonics, are among the most widely used insecticides in the world and are readily available in stores like Home Depot, Bi-Mart, Safeway, Lowe's. But few lay people, and I would include myself in that, understand the toxicity inherent in these products. Neonics are systemic, meaning they cannot be washed off. When exposed, an entire plant becomes toxic, including the pollen and nectar. Since neonics are water-soluble, they percolate into groundwater and then into our rivers and streams, affecting soil life, aquatic ecosystems, potentially even our drinking water. We consumers assume that products available over the counter are safe for use, and we rarely take the time to open and read application instructions. How many of us, as in the story earlier about the sluggo, will just say, well, if some is good, a little more must be even better? People from all over the world visit Oregon for the state's natural beauty, our rich and varied agriculture, our local foods, our great people, and the diversity of places to go and things to do. Our landscape is valuable both economically and environmentally. Not only our food and agricultural sectors depend on pollinators to make seeds. In fact, our landscapes do too. 90% of the plants in Oregon owe their existence to pollinators. Without pollinators, our beautiful madrones and lupins, as well as our farmers' markets, carrots, and strawberries would not reproduce. Without our mason bees, Harry and David, one of Southern Oregon's largest employers, would not exist. Without our leaf cutter bees, Oregon's alfalfa farmers would be out of business. Many gardening stores in my district sell safe alternatives to neonicotinoids. Home gardeners have many other options that are not harmful to bees. SB 929, or alternatively, if you choose, SB 928, will help us save our bee population. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I urge you to pass this legislation.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, let's have the return of Scott Dahlman, Jeff Stone, and Michelle Armstrong, please.
I think it was actually for the ice cream outside.
That's probably true. All right, Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. Once again, Scott Dahlman, Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter, representing farmers, foresters, other users of pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology, speaking here today in opposition to Senate Bills 928 and 929. I want to make it clear, the issue of bee health is important to all Oregonians, especially my members who are farmers, as they need pollinators and tools to control pests that attack their crops. And nobody wants to see adverse incidents involving pesticides and bees. But these bills are the wrong way to address potential issues. These products have all gone through extensive review through EPA before being registered. This review includes extensive safety testing, including honeybee acute contact toxicity, honeybee toxicity of residues on foliage, and field testing for pollinators. Also currently, the four major neonicotinoids are going through a re-registration review currently looking just at the issue of pollinators, and the drafts are out on that right now. And the good news from it is they're concluding that labeled uses of the product are not having an unreasonable risk to pollinators. So back in the 2014 session, Oregon took a proactive step to address pollinator health. If you remember, House Bill 4139 came forward, and that would have made neonicotinoids restricted use pesticides. At that time, the legislature determined this was a very complicated issue, and so it created a task force, the Pollinator Health Task Force, which met 10 times through 2014. I served on it, as did Jeff Stone and 10 other members, and we looked at this issue thoroughly and issued four priority recommendations. And Jeff will talk a little bit more about that, but I will just say one of the overarching things that came out of it was that bee health has no simple answers. There are a wide variety of issues that contribute to bee health declines, including mites, disease, pesticides, genetic diversity, and nutrition, and they're all contributing factors. I won't go through all of the priority recommendations, but I do want to mention that one of them was that Oregon should develop a strong, effective outreach and education strategy on pollinator health, including best management practices. A bill to do just that was passed in 2015, and Oregon State University is actively doing that work right now with outreach to applicators, both in agriculture and to the general public on this issue. And I would like to note that that is being funded through pesticide registration fees, that the industry stepped up to the plate, and we believe in having good education out there for people. So I won't go too much into the science around it, around neonicotinoids. I will point out one study. I have extensive public written comments that are on OLIS, which note all of these if you'd like to find more information. The most recent three-year bee study conducted by scientists from University of Maryland, US EPA, and the US Department of Agriculture confirmed what other research has shown, that field-relevant exposures of neonicotinoids have negligible effects on honeybee colony health, and that's referenced in the in my written comments. So I'll go a little bit into the specifics of why we have concerns with these specific bills. Senate Bill 928 is a set of labeling requirements around neonicotinoids, but we believe these requirements will not provide any meaningful information. The first is a requirement that pesticide products containing a neonicotinoid active ingredient be labeled with the term neonicotinoid on the front of it. Well, these products are already labeled with the name of the chemical on there. It is not hard to determine if a pesticide product contains a neonicotinoid. You look at the label. It's one of the first things listed on the label. New labels are also including what the EPA is calling a bee box. That is what was just handed around to you. What this does is points out very poignantly the risk to pollinators if the label is not followed and the precautions that should be taken while using them. I find it hard to believe that putting neonicotinoid on the front of it is going to have more of an impact for users than a box like this, which very well lays out the potential dangers and the precautions that need to be taken. We also think that this bill would be preempted under federal law, because under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, which regulates pesticide labels, it very clearly states that a state shall not impose or continue in effect any requirements for labeling or packaging in addition to or different from those required under this act. So we believe that would prevent a requirement in Oregon for having those. The second labeling requirement is around a container of agricultural seed that's coated with a neonicotinoid. Again, any of those products are already required under the Federal Seed Act to be labeled with the active ingredient if they are coated with a neonicotinoid. So adding the term neonicotinoid is not really providing any additional information that's already there for anybody who wants it. The final labeling requirement, and possibly the most concerning, is to label any raw agricultural or horticultural commodity that used neonics at any time during their life cycle. This requirement makes no distinction to if there's any residue left in the final product. It is a label that something was applied at some time, and it provides no useful information to the end consumer about what is left in that product, because these do break down over time. On Senate Bill 929, and I know I'm giving you a lot here, but with two bills, there's a lot of information on this, is the designation for restricted use pesticides for these products. This designation is very well laid out both in Oregon law and under federal law, and is supposed to be reserved for pesticide products that pose a high risk to humans or the environment. And a review of the current science, as you'll see from my written testimony, does not support such a designation for nicotinoids. In fact, EPA has reviewed these products with that in mind and decided not to give them that designation. So both EPA and ODA have that authority if they determine that it is needed, but we should let the experts there who have access to all the studies and all of the data make that determination, not tell them what to do. 929 does attempt to allow non-certified applicators who are commercial farmers to use these products, but the problem is that there's no current program in place that identifies who a farmer is. And so we don't know how Department of Ag would be able to make that workable so that a farmer can still go to the store and access these products, because there's no such thing as a farmer card to prove that you're a farmer. So the last thing I'll mention is that I think there is a false sense out there that if neonicotinoids are restricted, that homeowners who are using products to protect their plants around their home are just not going to use any other products. More likely, they will still go to the grocery store shelf and they will still pull off the product that is sitting there. And that will bring alternatives, and those alternatives have their own sets of trade-offs as well. Two of the main ones are organophosphates and pyrethroids, and both of them are also toxic to fish and to pollinators. And so you're not eliminating any risk by taking these products away. So for these reasons, we urge you to oppose Senate Bills 928 and 929, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Jeff. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I serve as the executive director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We oppose these two bills. You have 7 pages that I wrote for you. I'm sure that you will read every word, but just to be respectful for everybody who wants to testify, I'm just going to highlight a couple areas. As Mr. Dahlman indicated, I was part of the pollinator task force. In that task force, there was an opportunity to look at banning neonics and also placing it to make a suggestion that it be restricted. None of those were adopted or put forward for a big reason, that there is countervailing science. This is one of those issues that you can go find the science that suits your narrative. What we would like is for science to get its time to actually render the results that we would want long-term for the protection of pollinators. We are very committed. The nursery industry is a committed pollinator health advocate. But I would outline just a couple of areas where the task force made their case, and then I'll have one real reason why I think that there's a big decline in hive health. First of all, Oregon should develop a strong, effective outreach and education strategy. You heard that before. That is ongoing. I'm very proud of that. Oregon should fully fund a state-of-the-art bee diagnostic center through Oregon State University. As a duck, I support it. And third, an integrated pollinator health research plan should be developed to fund and improve understanding of the many issues affecting pollinators. And fourth, which is still yet to be done, is a sustainable funding source to meet all the needs for all the 3 prior recommendations. I had the opportunity when this issue broke. It was less than a mile from my office in Wilsonville. The application was made by a member of mine on National Pollinator Day. So it was not a shining moment. But the fact is that that applicator did it improperly. They applied it to flowering linden trees, which is already a big attractor to the bee population. But I had the opportunity to go testify before the U.S. House Committee in Washington, D.C., that Department of Agriculture, the Committee on Agriculture. And one thing stuck with me, and I brought a prop, because it stuck with me in D.C., and I'll have it stick with you next, is that one of the big issues facing pollinators is a mite called the varroa mite. It has an ability to attach itself to a single bee as it's out foraging, bring it back to the hive, and then it spreads. So if you think like chicken pox in a daycare center, it's like that. The relative size of the varroa mite to the human body is the size of this grapefruit. So it can be numerous places on the bee, it brings it in, and then spreads it. It is a big problem for pollinators, and we need to find ways, and science is looking at ways to get at the varroa mite. Also, forage areas are a big problem as well. Nutrition for bees. So all these things considered, yes, is there a role and acknowledgement that we need to look at all areas that impact the pollinator community? Yes, we certainly should. I think the two bills that are outlined in this, while maybe well-intentioned, are A, not ready, and B, the science needs to still determine it. And so you have 7 pages of my undivided attention that I provided this committee, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jeff. Michelle.
Thank you, Senator Dimbro and committee. My name is Michelle Armstrong. I work for Wilbur Ellis, and I am actually a pesticide consultant as well as a farmer. I grew up on a local dairy farm, and my parents said they had kids because we were the crew. So I did not, you know, I grew up working from the age of 5 or whatever along my parents and on. I wrote for you guys today, and you'll find it on your list, and I also provided you with handouts, a list of all of the crops and the pests that each neonicotide controls that we fight here in the state of Oregon. I have also bolded and asterisked some of the pests. And you will find that each one of those pests is listed as in a quarantine somewhere, at least in one county or more, within our state. These products are essential for our IPM program in fighting these pests. Some of the products that are alternatives to these are much more harmful, not only to pollinators or as harmful, but also harmful to humans. So these are some of our better choices that our farmers prefer to use to try and help us fight these pests. The growers would be at a disadvantage with out-of-state and out-of-country competition if not allowed to use these pests or if having to label their products listed at it. Our outside sources won't have to do that when shipping to other countries or shipping to outside sources. So it would be definitely a tough call for our farmers on this. And when used properly, in the 13 years I have been in this industry, or if you count even my childhood, I cannot recall personally seeing one incident when the pesticides have been used properly that we have had any problems with harming our pollinators. Some of these products even allow us to use these during bloom as long as the bees are not flying in the fields. And I have seen those uses, and we have not seen any bee deaths. And we've even talked to the beekeepers at the time. They understood, and they agreed to the applications, and that we had no problems whatsoever with those. The alternative pesticides are definitely pose potentially higher risks to the environment and to our humans. And many of the crops that are there, and we can use few softer chemistries and options to control piercing and sucking insects. A lot of those are very specific pests, and it's extremely hard to find products that control those pests. I also work with both conventional and organic farmers. And on a large scale, it is extremely hard to control pests organically. Many times I can sell, which of course is part of what I do, I'll end up selling 2 to 3 times more pesticides to control in organic than what I do in conventional by using a neonic to control the same pest. Plus, the farmers will tend to end up throwing away 20%+ more of their crop, either leaving it in the field or through the packing sheds, simply because of the damage caused by the pests that we cannot control organically as well on large-scale production. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Brzozinski.
Yeah, Jeff, I actually had a chance to read part of your 7 pages, not all. But I was curious because on the testimony you had for on pages 3 and 4, regarding the SB 929. Mm-hmm. You give some studies. I just looked at the years. One's 6 years old, the other one's 5 years old, and then I found some more recent ones. So I'm just wondering if you've had an opportunity to review the more recent studies and literature, because the literature shows stuff in the last year, including EPA finally admitting that
We can go neonics. It's easier.
Kill bees. And then also there was one that came out of the BBC looking at something that was done, a study in England, also linking long-term decline in the wild bee population.
Chair Denbrough, Senator Przanski, I'm going to attempt to answer your question. There are a number of studies. Yes, the ones that I provided in my testimony have varying lengths of time since they've been done. We've also committed as a nursery industry at the end of my testimony, when you get to pages 6 and 7, we are putting out an aggressive schedule through our Horticultural Research Institute and also through the OAN research side to get the best science. Not science that maybe that fits our narrative, but the one that really gets at the core issue of pollinator decline. In a lot of those studies that we've talked about, there's one and that's in Australia that's not too long ago, where they have placed neonics in there, but they haven't had the varroa mite. And the varroa mite is one that really has hit a lot of the hives more desperately. So I would say that while there is countervailing science, and I think that you're right to look at both outcomes of those science, when we're doing statewide policy like we are here, I would urge you caution.
Yeah, if I can follow up.
Please.
So I guess the only thing, I agree with that, and as you said earlier in your testimony, you can always find studies that are going to fit the position you have. So I'm not sure whenever we're going to get to that point, as you described, best science that we can rely on. But without reading the Australian study, but what you just said, if the mite is not there and they're seeing this as an issue, it seems to me we've isolated out the mite as an issue there in Australia, and it should seem that we'd have a corresponding response here. Yes, it may be something else that's also causing the destruction of the hives and the bees, but it seems to me that if you've taken the mite out, meaning they don't have that problem, mm-hmm. and they're still showing that this is an impact, we should be addressing it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, I appreciate the tenor of which you're asking the question. There is such strong countervailing science, and the big question is when do you know that you're at the end of the road? And I think that you have reviews that happen on these chemical classes. This particular chemical class is actually least harmful for human and environmental impacts. I think that you look at how these reviews are done. Were there detriments on how the labeling was happening at the federal level? And both Mr. Dahlman and myself made strenuous cases federally that there should be a bee box in order to make it not one that is born out of any language barriers, but also so there would be enough training at the nursery level, at any farm level, that it would be properly applied.
Okay, quickly.
Yeah, may I quickly respond to that? Thank you, Senator Denbrough. Senator Przanski, I would point out that I think that sometimes when you're looking at the studies, it's easy to become a bit confused because it's really what you were looking at. And what I mean by that is there's no debate that neonicotinoids can kill bees. If you spray an insect with an insecticide, that's the purpose of it. But what you see is how it affects them in lab conditions based on versus what the actual exposure level is in field conditions. And what we're seeing in field conditions are not levels that are causing the declines. And so that's, I think, the big differences you're seeing there. There's no debate about whether if you apply a neonicotinoid to a bee, whether it will kill it.
Okay, thank you, all three. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to briefly close this public hearing. on these two bills, and I'm going to open our work session on Senate Bill 3 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 8 amendments to the bill. So, Senator Olson.
Chair Denver, I move to adopt the Dash 8 amendments dated 3/24/17.
Senator Olson has moved to adopt the Dash 8 amendments dated 3/24/17. Okay, can we have it quiet here, please? Thanks. Okay, colleagues, let me just quickly summarize the Dash 8s. So you'll remember that we had our public hearing on this bill back, I think it was February 6th, right at the beginning of the session. And we have been working on it ever since. Been working with Senator Roblin, Senator Girard, Senator Boquist, the agency, a number of people, to try to take an approach that would really respond to the concerns that we heard here in this room from people, both you know, who were concerned about the impact of suction dredge mining on fish and habitat, and also on those who felt that Senate Bill 3 was an overreach. And we believe that we've come up with kind of a common sense way of addressing this issue, one that is simple and easy to implement. In a nutshell, what the amendments do is they say that in streams that are deemed to be essential salmonid habitat, there will be no more suction dredge mining. In all other rivers, suction dredge mining can be permitted. And those permits will be subject to place and manner regulation, as well as you know, concerns for to make sure that habitat is respected. And you know, if you're doing it and you see salmon eggs or lamprey, you stop mining in that area, that sort of thing. It also creates a fee schedule for the permit. The DEQ can assess up to a $250 permit fee or less if it so chooses. And that, I think, is largely what we're dealing with here. So I'd be happy to answer questions, or Senator Roblin, if you'd like.
Yeah, I just want to make a statement because I really appreciate the work that our chair has done on this, along with my other Republican colleagues that worked with us. For me, the lamprey habitat was really important because I have a number of tribes, and it's a food source and a historic source. We have never actually mapped out where lamprey are. But the maps we have done have been clear that where salmon habitat is, they exist. So when you take the salmon habitat that we do know, it matches most of the area that lamprey were in. And I think that's really great. The other part of the bill says if you find them when you're and they would be floating along in your when you're panning or when you're doing other stuff, then you stop doing it because you can't, you're not supposed to kill them. And I think for the most part, when I've talked to suction dredge miners, they do care about the environment, and they do want to not have that. So the way it's been written, I really appreciate the fact that we are going to protect the important habitat for our spawning salmon and for the lamprey, who spend more time in the gravel than do the salmon eggs. They're there up to a year and a half, 2 years in their one stage before they go out to the ocean and come back. So I thought it was really good compromise. I really appreciate all the people that worked with that to come up with where we are, and I really appreciate you sticking with it and the people who did, because it was a lot of meetings and a lot of writing by our people in the our attorneys.
Yeah. Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
No, let's see. Do you have something to say?
I was just going to clarify one other thing, and that is the maps that designate where we have essential salmonid habitat are determined by our Department of State Lands through a rulemaking process. So every 4 or 5 years, they go through a public process if those maps need to be changed. And so, you know, for those of you who are not really familiar with our process, a rulemaking process is a public process where different individuals can come in and give testimony and comment on, you know, the correctness of those maps. So,
thank
Vice
you.
Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to just talk about the process itself. I've been here from the beginning, and I was opposed to it in the very beginning because of the fact that we were banning miners. I thought the process was wrong. I thought the science was wrong when we talked about the fact that they were destroying salmon habitat. The problem was that Department of Fish and Wildlife didn't think so. Department of Fish and Wildlife, in the letters they've written to me, actually stated that they weren't on the water when we had spawning salmon. And the problem I have was the expansion. When we went from salmonoids and we added lampreys and mollusks and bull trout and everything else to make it try to fit scientifically. This is a good piece of work. I'm not saying that you guys didn't do a great piece of work. But to be clear, when this bill comes to the floor, I will let you know that I have 12 bottles of water. So I plan to speak to it very diligently. I think it was a disservice to our miners. I think that we probably could have solved our problem through a rule rather than totally banning everything. I will probably vote to move this to the floor, but I will discuss it on the floor and let my actually, no, I'm not going to. I'm going to say no. I need to say no.
No to the bill to the floor or no to the amendment?
No, the amendment I'll pass. It's a good amendment, but it'll be no to the bill to the floor because I think the miners, I think we did a disservice to the miners. This kind of gets it back a little bit, but it's still a disservice.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion?
Do we have a motion?
We do have a motion.
I'll call the question. So we can move on back to the public hearings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. We're on
yeah.
The dashing.
Great. Okay, so
did we pass the eights?
No, we have had a motion to adopt the eights. Seeing no further discussion, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 8. Senate Bill 3, and colleagues, we do have the paperwork for this, but Senator Bertschinger wanted to be here for the vote, so we'll yep. vote
oh,
in.
Oh, so we're just doing the amendment.
On
that's
Wednesday. Just,
yeah, that's
great.
Good.
Carry over the work session to tomorrow. We have to carry it over a couple times.
Oh, later. Right. Okay, so because we're meeting tomorrow, we're going to, I'll carry over the work session on Senate Bill 3 to, and then tomorrow I'll announce the intention to carry it over to the following day, to Wednesday.
Mr.
We
Chair,
meet Tuesday night.
Oh, so this is going to be part of the Tuesday night meeting?
No, tomorrow night I will carry it over to Wednesday. We will vote on it on Wednesday.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just do it, because, I mean, you could post for Wednesday today for Wednesday, but that's fine.
Well, 3 o'clock is 4:30.
Yeah, it's too
for
late.
Wednesday? We need 48 hours or 24?
48.
Okay.
Inside the building baseball. Sorry, folks. Okay, I'm going to reopen our public hearings on Senate Bill 928 and Senate Bill 929. Can we have Paul Jepson and Marv Sanders, please? You have signed up as neutral, and we always have room for neutral. Professor
Jepson. He may be outside. He may be coming in.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes takes a while to get people here.
I had a few slides, but in the interest of time and the fact that so many people wish to speak, what I might do is just summarize the major messages from that and just let everybody know that I'm assuming this material will be available on websites for those to consult, and you'll be able to see that. So for brevity, I would just briefly summarize my points.
That's great, Dr. Jepson. If you could just identify yourself for the record,
please. Thank you. I'm Paul Jepson. I'm the state IPM coordinator for Oregon. I direct the Integrated Plant Protection Center at Oregon State University. I was really moved to talk about this because of factors that I felt the committee should consider in decision policy making with regard to pesticide regulation, because there's some unique features to this that I wanted you to be aware of in your deliberations. And secondly, I wanted to talk about OSU's role under existing mandates, because I'm speaking on behalf of some colleagues of mine here as well. I summarise at the outset that I've got wide experience in invertebrate toxicology. I work in integrated pest management in the state and globally. And one particular thing I wanted to note was work that I've undertaken has just led to the phasing out of three of the neonicotinoid insecticides under consideration in more than 50 countries for certified commodities for groups such as the Rainforest Alliance and the Sustainable Agriculture Network. So in places where there's insufficient education and use patterns are rather unknown and these pesticides are applied to pollinated crops, we felt the uncertainties were great enough to justify the phasing out of some of these materials from 50 countries, and this is affecting 10 million farmers at least. So that gives you a little bit of the background that I've been personally engaged in for some considerable period. However, what this bill seeks to do is identify a whole class of pesticides, and that's never been done before. That's a rather unique thing, because the materials that fall under this class have wildly distinctive properties. Some of the materials are not so toxic to bees and are extremely efficacious for some important pest management uses in Oregon. I felt you ought to be aware of that. So briefly, to regulate a complete class of pesticides rather than individual members of it is not compatible with current regulatory process anywhere. It's not compatible with a cost-benefit approach, which is required under the Federal Insecticide and Rodenticides Act, and doesn't meet the requirements of the restricted use pesticide classification to quantify that the decrease in risk exceeds the decrease in benefits that would be taking place. It fails to consider differences between the products, and it does not include chemistries from other mode of action groups that are also toxic to bees. And similarly, it doesn't consider other risks, including risks to workers, vertebrates, and aquatic life. So, and finally, it doesn't consider the likelihood or even inevitability of risk substitution. Now, I've given testimony previously to this august body regarding potential banning of neonicotinoids in agriculture, where I pointed out that risk substitution may occur. In fact, since I last spoke to you, because of impositions of or restrictions of neonicotinoid use in the marketplace rather than through regulation, farmers in the Clackamas watershed have returned to using chlorpyrifos, a highly toxic organophosphate in Oregon, and to reverse a 12-year decline in the occurrence of chlorpyrifos in surface waters, we now have an increase in both the level of detection and the frequency of detection of this compound in the Clackamas watershed. So always in regulatory decision-making, one considers trade-offs. And in this case, there has an increase in the harm to fish. I asked myself the question, what would be the likely consequence of a blanket ban of an effect of this measure of having restricted use classification for neonicotinoids for homeowners and unlicensed landscape operators? And there are many broad-spectrum pesticides available to those groups in Oregon that pose much greater risk to human health and the environment. We have particular concern for sensitive subpopulations, the elderly, the infirm, who devote themselves to gardening and can go to a store in Oregon and buy a 50% organophosphate solution. They can buy synthetic pyrethroids. They can trigger pest outbreaks and have to apply five times instead of once. And so I have to represent really a concern that a blanket ban for a class of chemistry that isn't uniformly toxic to bees could have adverse consequences. I've given you in my testimony an example of the type of education materials we're in the act of developing for homeowners, and these use pictograms to indicate the relative risks of different materials to aquatic life, to vertebrate wildlife, to humans, and to natural enemies of crop pests and to bees. And so we're actively pursuing this under other mandates within our state. Previously, this body acted to enable a pollinator health position to be established at OSU, and Andoni Melathopoulos is a fabulous faculty member that we attracted from Canada. He's been with us for 3 months, and I'm already working with him and other colleagues extensively on developing a public education process to address neonicotinoids, but also the trade-offs with other risks. particularly where a decision to use an organophosphate or a pyrethroid might propose have adverse consequences for aquatic life, for humans, or for pets or other wildlife. So I urge you to consider the consequences of having a blanket approach, which would be very unusual, if not unheard of, under regulatory process, and to consider the individual risks these products pose, and to have ODA and others to consider under other mandates the possibility of further restrictions. I'm neutral, however, because there is no doubting the propensity of these materials to cause extreme risk to wild and to hive bees. And something does need to be done, but addressing it in such a way strikes me as having a potential for adverse and unintended consequences that require consideration before the bill passes on to further consideration. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Professor. Yes, Senator Rubin.
I just want to thank you for being on the staff at OSU and for the others, the new person that we hired. I think that the more we can get neutral science to kind of help guide us in the right direction, the better off we are. And I know that the work you guys are doing at OSU on pest management of things has been well received by our farming community and others. And clearly, when you come up and say that you shouldn't be doing this, they change. I mean, our community that's out there producing food for us cares very deeply about the science that you guys are producing. So thank you for your efforts. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. And Senator Roblin and Committee Dunbar, can I make one brief comment, please?
Sure.
I think a statement was made earlier that until we get to the end of the story, we can't really act. And I personally, as a scientist who works in risk assessment and regulatory affairs, that's not the basis upon which decisions are made. The decisions are often made on the basis of uncertainty. How much, you know, we don't know quite a lot of things. We don't know what rate homeowners are applying these products. We don't know to a full extent the toxicity that certain of these materials pose, not others. And so on the basis of those uncertainties, the steps that have been taken in the broader world of export horticulture that I described earlier were taken with the science in mind, knowing that we've not got to the end of the story yet. And that may be a slightly more precautionary approach than we used to take in the United States, but it doesn't mean that attention is not deserved for some of these materials that do have a record for harm. Whether or not the science is sometimes contradictory, that can occur. So uncertainty can be a driver for decision-making to take action. It's just that in this particular case, by being so inclusive, the baby could potentially be thrown out with the bathwater, and that's why I felt moved to speak. Thank you very much.
We could say the same thing on climate change, right?
Thank you very much, Professor.
Well, we could say the same thing about climate change, it seems, because if 99% of the scientific community wasn't wholly convinced that it's actually taking place.
Well, the alternative facts kind of seem to give us something else until the end. Even though we have 99.9% agreeing, it's still not the end for some people.
That 99% figure is a rumor, I hear. Okay, so we're going to move now to our further testimony. And because of the time pressure that we're under, I can't promise that we'll get to everyone. But I'm going to ask everyone who is called up to keep their testimony under 3 minutes. Okay, we'll have a timer going. And as is our practice, I'm going to ask first for people who have traveled more than 100 miles to be here to speak first. So if we could have Pat Morris, Alan Widmire, and Kenda Swartz, please. So we have 3 minutes, but if you could keep it shorter, that would be even greater. The more we'll be able to hear from people. Pat, you want to go first?
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Pat Morris. I'm a professional beekeeper. I'm from Gold Hill, Oregon, which is in Jackson County. I've been a beekeeper for over 30 years, and for about the last 20 years, I've been a beekeeper in Jackson County. I'm here specifically to talk about the non-lethal doses of neonicotinoids within the hive. And so as the workers in the hive mature, each worker has certain jobs to do. What they found is that these jobs are done according to pheromones or smells. What happens when neonicotinoid is in the pollen and brought back to the hive, it's stored in the cells itself. That neonicotinoid goes throughout all of the wax, which acts like a liver in the hive, so it's stored there permanently. And even as they make new wax, the nicotinoid spreads to that wax. As that smell and the poison, well, sorry, poor word, but the neonicotinoids are smelled in there, the bees that are supposed to be feeding the larva actually don't know that it's their job to feed the larva. And so as they're supposed to be feeding their larva and not, you have a colony that's dying, and that's why you're getting a lot of the bee losses, especially during the winter when they're stuck in the hive the whole time. That's all I want to say.
Thank you very much, Pat. Okay, Alan?
Hello, I'm Alan Widmeyer from Ashland, over there on the far end of the state. And one of my concerns is that this class of pesticide is a very persistent pesticide and can last as much as 9 or so years. And if we're noticing an effect now, and whenever we do decide to take action to limit the spread of this throughout the environment, we must keep in mind that it's going to be 9 more years after we stop doing that that we'll be receiving the negative effects on our bee populations for 9 more years. So I urge the utmost caution in the use of these. Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
Hello. My name is Kenda Swartz. I'm from Jacksonville, Oregon. I'm a member of Pollinator Project Rogue Valley. And I'm standing today for the pollinators and no particular bottom line, unless you consider food and the survival of a human species a bottom line. I have written a poem, so I'm doing something unconventional. It's called The Last to Be. She rested gently in his soft young hand. In awe he stared at a smallness so grand. What have we done? In earnest he pleaded. They forgot, she whispered, how much we are needed. But I don't understand, he cried through his tears. You're not to blame, she said. It's been occurring for years. How can I help? His angst ever growing. You cannot, she replied. It's just too late for knowing. You see, wisdom too often arrives too late. People long ago determined my fate. Sadly, humans are blind about toxicity. Their willful lack of insight results in complicity. Be kind and wise, she tried to explain. Please ensure that my species has not died in vain. Will you think of me, I mean, after I depart? He answered in silence by way of broken heart. She fell to her side, struggling to upright, the senseless poisons winning the fight. Fragility replaced a once lively existence. There was no cure for her failing resistance. Weakened and frail, the bee acquiesced. The child bargained and pleaded, trying his best. One final buzz on delicate wings. The last bee on earth no longer sings. I'm asking you to make this decision not just for now, but for future generations. They say hindsight is 20/20, but I don't think we have the luxury of hindsight. I think we need to see clearly now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. Dick Corrigan, Kathleen Herring, and Christiana. Boy, you got me.
She's after me.
Okay.
After Kathleen.
Great. Okay, Dick, you want to start?
No, I'm Dick Corrigan from Talent, Oregon, B-City, Talent, Oregon. And I'm here to represent myself as a backyard gardener and other members of our community who do backyard gardening. I'm in favor particularly of 929 Senate Bill. I see it as unnecessary for backyard gardeners to have these neonicotinoids available to us. There are many alternatives to that, and a lot of us use them inappropriately, as I've heard gardeners here talk about. So I think they're unnecessary. It's a little confusing to me coming to this hearing and hearing facts and some things I think may be alternative facts, and also wondering about in the news, while countries around the world, sovereign countries, refuse to allow neonicotinoids as they do GMOs, and we're still doing it. So I'm in favor of this legislation, especially 929, and I appreciate this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gorgon. Kathleen?
Hello, Senators. My name is Kathleen Herring. I'm from Ashland, Oregon, and a healthcare professional. As a healthcare professional, I would like to explain the effect of pesticides on human health. Notice I said pesticides. Sides, anything that ends in sides means death. So it doesn't matter what the classification is. Many here are testifying on behalf of pollinators. I here am testifying on behalf of humans. Neonicotinoids and other pesticides affect humans by killing their gut flora or bacteria. We are alive because of bacteria in our gut. Those bacteria help us not only to digest our food, but to absorb the nutrients from our food. If we use pesticides on our food plants, the pesticides are absorbed by the plant and then in our food. And they are present in our food, tested. This is from a study that was done on food in the Congress, being fed to congressmen, present in most foods, unless you're eating organic. We may not think that it is affecting us, but it is. It is affecting our gut health by killing bacteria in our gut and gradually decreasing our body's ability to have nutrients available. This helps create chronic diseases. And this is one of the reasons why when you hear testimony, it's like, well, a lot of people are talking about the immediate effect. Yes, neonicotinoids might not cause this instant death like some of the organic phosphates, but it's the long-term picture. According to Beyond Pesticides, in a study done several years ago, more pesticides are used by people in home gardens and lawns than commercial use. Bill SB 929 would remove these pesticides from the shelves so that homeowners would not inadvertently harm the pollinators or humans.
Thank you very much. Christiana.
My name is Christina Lefevre. I traveled with 13 other people from Southern Oregon today to be here to show our support for our pollinators. I'd like to start off by thanking Senator Prozanski and also our representative Pam Marsh for her comments today on this important bill. We all agree that it is time to save Oregon's pollinators, and with your help, we can classify the neonicotinoids as restricted use pesticides and take them off of store shelves. We heard a lot today about the impacts to farmers and nurseries, and this is a consumer bill, so those people that are still licensed would still have access to use those. People don't know. I had an example. My next-door neighbor went and purchased a product, and he told me how he was going to use it, and as soon as he told me that, I knew what it was. He didn't know. He's not going to read that little label. Most people aren't. And then, as Ms. Vollmer explained, most people think less is more. So even if, as we heard, we labeled these things with a little box that said this is dangerous to bees, okay, well, it's dangerous to bees and other pollinators. So in that case, then why is that product on the shelf? Our pollinators are the basis of life. Without our pollinators, we don't eat. Nothing eats. Our land, our mountains can slide off the mountains because our sides of the mountains can slide off the mountains because there's no roots and no plants to hold them up. So we need to have our pollinators. We need to have our soil life. We need our aquatic life. And the studies do show that they are affecting the life for 20 years. And so what we need to do with starting with a consumer bill is take these products off of store shelves so that people who don't know can not have access to them. There are alternatives. Yes, there are some really bad ones, and maybe we need to address those next. But there are other more safe alternatives to the neonicotinoids, and people are selling them. You can go to the stores, and you can find those other products that are not going to harm us. or the pollinators. Thank you for supporting 929.
Thank you, Christiana. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we have one more of our 100-plus, in our 100-plus club, Nina Friedman and Lisa Arkin.
Lisa's not 100 miles.
She checked it.
She missed by about 40, but that's okay.
She's not 100 miles. She lives my
100 kilometers?
Maybe.
Okay, Nina, welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Nina Friedman. I'm the Save the Bees coordinator for the SOU chapter of Augsburg. Much of what I have to say today will echo much of what you've heard already. I want to say thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to all of us speak. And I'll dive right in since my time is short. The bees are dying all over the world, and they're dying here at home. And we all know that bees are important. They, with their disappearance, so will hundreds of food and plant species that depend on them for pollination. In fact, 89% of native Oregon plant species depend on bees or other pollinators for future future plant seed generations. Bees are a keystone species, playing an integral role to our ecosystem, but they should also be seen as a sentinel species, much like the classic example of the canary in the coal mines. Those birds served as an early detector of carbon monoxide for miners so that they could escape in time to not be killed in the mines. Neonicotinoids, now the most commonly bought insecticides in the world, are neurotoxins. They have the ability to hurt the bee's nervous system, disabling them to find their way back to the hive. Excuse me. I urge you to vote yes in support of this bill today because bees are our modern day canaries. The harmful effects that neonicotinoids are having on our buzzing little friends have large implications for the health of humans as well. For the health of ourselves, for our ecosystem, and for our future generations, I urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 929. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lisa.
For the record, Lisa Arkin, Executive Director of Beyond Toxics, and I want to thank students for coming all the way from Southern Oregon to testify on behalf of bees. Thank you. And the children in the audience, too, because bees are in crisis. And I am speaking to both Senate Bill 928 and 929, so I hope you'll give me a little extra time doing two at once. Pollinators are in crisis. The federal government under the Trump administration has listed a native bee, a native bumblebee, on the endangered species list. The rusty patch bumblebee has the notorious status of nearing its complete demise, thus robbing farmers and future generations of this effective and hardworking pollinator. By adding the rusty patch bumblebee to the endangered species list, we now have 8 species of native bees listed as endangered. We are in crisis. It's well known that bees are suffering due to a number of environmental impacts. One of the top contributors to the decline of pollinators is exposures to neonicotinoid pesticides. This class are neurotoxins, and most importantly, they weaken the ability of the bee to survive other threats, such as the varroa mite that was mentioned before by Jeff Stone. Just like a human, when our immune system is compromised, we're less able to fight off other diseases and problems such as viruses. And they harm a bee's ability to forage for pollen, nectar, find their way back home, and care for the baby bees in the hive, the next generation. Let's start with labeling plants. Plants that have been pre-treated before they are sold are an attractive trap, a death trap, actually, for bees. These pesticides are systemic and persistent poisons. They accumulate in the nectar, the pollen, even the little sweat of the plant or the dew that the bees drink early in the morning. A bee visiting a flower treated with neonicotinoids can die on contact or bring these poisons back to the hive. And consumers don't want to buy plants to attract bees to their garden. But labeling is only part of the answer. Labeling can only do so much. And in my testimony on OLIS, and I'll hold up the picture. I've given you a picture of a label that was found in a Home Depot store in Oregon, and it's simply confusing and misleading. So unless labels are done correctly, the labeling won't actually help. Rather, it's better to take these things out of the hands of innocent and unsuspecting consumers that are not trained to use them. So Senate Bill 929, the Oregon Pollinator Protection Act, provides a more certain means of protecting bees. And I want to just state for the record that this is not unprecedented. The state of Maryland just passed this nearly exact same bill in 2016, and a number of other states are considering Pollinator Protection Act like Senate Bill 929 as well. True, we have other bad insecticides out there in the market that are harmful, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do right now while we can. So in closing, with 90% of our flowering trees and plants at the risk of not having seed for the next generation, let's act now to protect plants and act to protect our humans from other very toxic pesticides as well. And I promise to be working with Dr. Jepson on this. He and I spoke after this hearing, and we'll get together. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Lisa. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you both. Okay, can I have Thurman Main, Bill Case, and Blake Rowe? Welcome, gentlemen. Bill, you want to start us off?
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Bill Case. I'm a farmer in the Albany area. I grow about 1,000 acres of sweet corn for the fresh market. All goes to Safeway, Fred Meyer, the local stores. The problem I'm having with this is the only state that I really can't sell into is Oregon. I sell Canada, Oregon, Washington, California, everywhere else without labeling. Now, the chemical we use, and it's used on sweet corn seed, is Cruiser. 95% of the corn seed planted in the United States uses Cruiser. And it lasts 35 to 42 days planted in the ground. So by the time the corn gets up, it's Cruiser's gone. It's corn takes anywhere from 78 to 90 days. The problem I have is I pack approximately 7,000 boxes a day, 7 days a week. I pack one day and I ship the next morning because I have to leave it in the cooler all night to bring the temperature down. I never know where that corn's going. It could go Oregon, Washington, Canada, wherever. So I can't label it because I don't know where it's going to go the next day. So it's a real problem for us is that and if stuff doesn't last, it's gone. And so I can go to every other state, but I have problems in Oregon. Other growers out of state can come into Oregon with no problem. The problem I have is my own state. And it's a real disadvantage to an Oregon grower. Now, there's other chemicals. We don't spray any of these chemicals. It's only on the seed treatment. And it's for seed maggots and whatever. It's in the ground that attacks the seed. And so that's the thing that's bothering me is I just never know where I'm going from one day to the next because it has to set in the cooler overnight. And the next day it could all go to Oregon or it could all go to California. And that's a real problem. And the way this law is written or this thing is it's written so that it affects only me and not the other people that are coming into Oregon. They can all come in with no problems, and I'm the one that gets caught up in this thing. So I think it's a real disadvantage to Oregon growers the way this thing is written. So, okay.
Thanks, Mr.
Thank you.
I may have a question for you.
Good afternoon. My name is Thurman Main. I am a category manager for Wilco Farm Stores. I've been involved personally in the nursery business for just about 30 years, seen lots of chemicals come and go, things that they touted as wonderful at one time and weren't others. I've seen others such as Carbaryl stay around for a very long time, have a long shelf life, relatively long use for consumers. And I'm reiterating some things that have been said already. Some of these, I carry few of these items actually on our shelves at Wilco. However, if these items were to go away, they wouldn't be just, nothing else would, that's less harmful necessarily would be taking their place. Organophosphates, which you heard Dr. Jebson talk about, can be much more toxic to the individual as well as children, pets, etc. The neonics that are sold at Wilco are not sold for use on edibles. And for anybody who talks about the fact that we need to label this nice gentleman's sweet corn, that it's neonicotinoids, but we can't trust them to read the label and apply a chemical correctly, that sort of seems to me like where we are talking out of both sides of our mouth. At this point, to reduce the use of what a consumer is going to use and what is still going to be out there in agriculture and professional use, the consumer is a very small portion of what is going to be used out there, and the items that we've seen thus far have been inappropriate use by so-called professionals. Wilco is against 929 for these reasons. One other thing on the overview report by the Australian Pesticides Veterinary Medicine Authority, which we were speaking to earlier in the 2014 one, this is a quote. Information and advice available to the APVMA suggests that in Australia, honeybee populations are not in decline and insecticides are not a highly significant issue, even though they are clearly toxic to bees if used incorrectly. Incidents of beekeeper losing bee colonies as a result of insecticide use do occur, but this most often arises because there has been a breakdown in communication between farmers and affected beekeepers. So please, the understanding I think that you had before was incorrect.
You know, the understanding I had was based on someone making a statement as to the study. I have not read that study.
Okay.
I was referring to the statement they made there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Blake.
Jared Embrough, members of the committee. My name is Blake Rowe. I'm the CEO for the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and we're proud to represent nearly 2,000 farms across Oregon that produce wheat. It's one of our state's largest and most valuable crops. So a large majority of Oregon's wheat production is conventional, and many, if not most, of our conventional growers use neonicotinoid products as a seed treatment to protect their wheat seed and the young plants from pests like wireworms and aphids. It's common. Used, as you've heard, in a very similar way on many other crops. So they're very important to us as producers. So I'll touch a little bit on, 928 is mostly focused on labeling, really in three areas, pesticide products and seed, and maybe on those two, I think you're really dealing with an area that is pretty well regulated already. FIFRA at the federal level is very prescriptive and precise about what goes into a pesticide label, and I don't really think you might even have a conflict if you try to overlay that with additional language, but it's done at the federal level. Similar for treated seed, the Federal Seed Act pretty well prescribes how seed is labeled. It is very clear, and it's covered. The area where we'd probably comment that maybe we have a little philosophical problem or conflict with the approach when you get past the requirements for a food label or a product label about safety, ingredients, things that are nutrition, things that are prescribed at the federal level, we like the approach, a positive approach. So if a grower wants to feature something about their product, like pollinator friendly or organically grown or whatever it is, you know, we commend them for that. That's a marketing, that's a positive marketing message. We have a little problem when you get into telling a grower, forcing a grower to say something that really isn't a positive message or in his best interest. So, you know, if you want labels that promote grow products that don't use neonicotinoids or are pollinator friendly, you know, we'd probably say fine. It's when you force a grower to put a label on a product that's really a negative statement to the market. That's where we have a little bit of grief. And you really don't need SB 928 to do positive labeling. It already exists. I've seen products in the at Home Depot not grown with neonicotinoids. Positive message from the grower. It's fine. If that appeals to the market, more power to them. The reverse, where it's forced on the growers, is where we have a little grief. So 929, I'll touch on that very quickly. We very much appreciate that farmers are allowed to continue to use neonics. It just seems, as you've heard, seems a little bit of a big step to take an entire class of chemicals and say the citizens of Oregon are no longer entitled to purchase those compared to citizens in the other 49 states of the union. We think it's a little bit of a big step. We got a good system with ODA to identify precise things where we need to change or modify labels. Really don't see a need to do a blanket approach like this. Thank you.
Right. One, thank you.
Can I have one more second?
Okay.
I use about 100 beehives every year in my squash and pumpkins, and I've never heard a beekeeper ever come up with anything like this as far as losing bees. I mean, I use them every year. I've used them for 20, 30 years, and I've never heard one of them say anything about it.
Thank you.
Thank
Bill.
You.
But we have heard some, you know, some
yeah.
examples. Just one question, just to clarify, and I think you know you touched on this at the end, Blake. This Senate Bill 929 does not apply to licensed applicators or farmers, really.
And, correct.
But the Wheat Growers League would still be opposed to it, even though they would not be directly affected by it. I guess that's the question.
Again, it's a philosophical objection. So I believe we would, I could say, not believe, we would oppose this bill. It's just unnecessary to do this kind of blanket statement, you know.
That this requires a license.
Just unnecessary. Yeah.
Okay. You're saying I'm not required to label then?
You're actually not required.
What?
Because you're a farmer.
Best thing I've heard all day.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sleep well tonight.
I will.
Okay. So it's after 5. I think we have time just for one more panel each side. Okay. Is that okay? And Senator Roblin, you don't need to stay, but I'll stay
I'll
for
look.
This.
I think I have somebody in my office right now. So.
Great. So let's have Lorianne Bird. Is Tom Wolf here?
Yes.
Wow. and Mia, oh, I'm sorry, Micah. Micah Maskell. Lorianne, you want to start?
Sure. Hi, my name is Lorianne Bird, and I'm the Environmental Health Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. I'm here today on behalf of myself, the Center, and our thousands of Oregon supporters. Thousands of studies have proven the role of neonicotinoid insecticides in bee declines. The science is clear. Claiming scientific uncertainty is merely a tactic to delay much-needed action. These toxic pesticides cause both acute impacts, the die-offs that we've talked about, and also subacute impacts, which can include weakening communication skills, decreasing memory that makes it hard for bees to find their way home, and suppressing defenses to varroa mites and other pathogens. Our native bees are even more sensitive to neonicotinoids than honeybees, and studies on various native bee species have found everything from a 50% decrease in offspring production, zero reproduction in one study, and an 85% drop in bumblebee queen production. I'm going to briefly touch on the EPA risk assessments that were alluded to earlier. So EPA has released risk assessments on the four most commonly used neonics, and it said, quote, most approved uses do not pose significant risks to bee colonies. Those risk assessments are fundamentally flawed in three ways, and I'll focus on the first one that they put out on imidacloprid. The first, that first one, and these are, again, preliminary, and hopefully the final risk assessments will correct these fatal errors. The conclusion was that the effects were on individual bees, not colonies. The basis for that conclusion was one single industry-funded study. So we've sent EPA additional studies to consider that will hopefully contravene that finding. They also looked exclusively at exposure to nectar, which I'm not a beekeeper, but my understanding is that bees interact with pollen quite a bit as well. So hopefully they'll correct that. And they only looked at one pollinator species, the honeybee, which honeybees are wonderful, but there are thousands of other pollinator species. And if they're going to call it a pollinator risk assessment, they, of course, need to look at other pollinators. We're very deeply concerned about what these neonicotinoid insecticides are doing to our native bee species. Earlier this month, we released a report, the first time ever assessing the status of all 4,337 North American native bees. Our key findings: amongst native bees with sufficient data to assess, more than half are declining, and nearly one in four is imperiled and at increasing risk of extinction. And a significant driver of these declines is pesticide use, especially neonicotinoid use. The decline of Oregon's native bees is a threat to agriculture and is also a threat to our natural ecosystems. Almost 90% of wild plants are dependent on insect pollination, and bees are indispensable to our ecosystems. One of Oregon's native bees, the Franklin's bumblebee, may have already gone extinct on our watch, but over 200 native bee species have called Oregon home, and timely action to restrict the use of neonicotinoids could save some of these bees. If we don't take action to save our native bees, we can say goodbye to the pleasure of feasting on ripe huckleberries in the summertime, and our world will be a less colorful and more lonesome place. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Chair Dembro and committee, for the record,
all here in spirit.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited. And I just want to talk real briefly. I sent in a presentation that I was going to do on thinking downstream in a paper written by some scientists in Europe that's one of the best of about 10 studies I have on the impact of neonicotinoids on aquatic ecosystem. And I guess what I'm going to say, and I'll say this very in the quickest manner possibly, is neonicotinoids don't only affect bees, they affect aquatic macroinvertebrates, and they have a very negative impact on stream. There's research, as I stated, being done that show that they affect the biodiversity of the streams. They have an impact on the mayflies, on the stoneflies, on the caddisflies, and cause the demise on that. They have a impact because they impact a type of insect that lives in the streams called shredders. Shredders are able to eat leaves that fall into the stream, and without shredders, stream can build up a heavy composition of this debris that can have a negative impact on the stream. So, in short, I hope that you get a chance to read both the presentation, the slide presentation that I didn't get a chance to do, the paper that I submitted. But it's not just about bees. It's about the impact the neonicotinoids have on macroinvertebrates and how it could impact all fish and the other species that live in our rivers and streams. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Chair Dembro, my name is Micah Meskel. I'm with Audubon Society of Portland. I'm representing our 17,000 state members. So the Audubon Society of Portland strongly supports passage of both SB 928 and 929. Neonics are persistent, widely used pesticides that are causing well-documented harm to wildlife and in particular pollinators. SB 928 and SB 929 would represent significant steps forward in protecting our state's biodiversity. The threat presented by neonics was recognized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2015 when they announced a ban of the use of neonicotinoids on over 150 million acres of land. While these two bills would not allow or would allow continued use of neonicotinoids in Oregon, they would put in place important significant safeguards to protect the state's wildlife, provide information to the public, and help ensure that the application was only done by trained professionals. We view both bills as common sense steps. The dramatic impacts that neonicotinoids have on bees have appropriately received tremendous attention over the years. But as Tom mentioned, bees are just the tip of the iceberg. Neonicotinoids eliminate a wide array of terrestrial and aquatic invertebrates on which many species, including salmon and birds, depend. With regards to birds, neonicotinoids have profound impacts. A single seed treated with neonicotinoids can kill a songbird. And that can be a corn seed or a wheat seed or many other different types of seeds. Chronic exposure of neonicotinoids can have significant sublethal effects, including decreased fecundity. Neonicotinoids destroy the insects which many birds depend on for survival. A recent study correlates declines in insectivorous bird populations with increased use of neonicotinoids and concludes that neonicotinoids eliminate insects on which serve as a primary food source for birds. So in parting, we urge the committee to pass both SB 928 and 929 out of committee and to move both bills towards passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Micah. I have no questions for you. I had to look inside. Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Roger Beyer, Greshwill, Josh Zielinski, and if she'll pull up a chair, Jenny Dressler can testify. And that will be it for that side. And friends, I had indicated this would be the last panel, but I hear that we have some children who would like to testify, so we'll have one additional panel.
Okay. Chair Dambrow, committee. My name is Lee Geshwal. Thank you for the opportunity to go on record in opposition of these two bills. You have my written testimony submitted to you, so I will keep my comments brief. I think the issue with these two bills is the method in which they get to the goal. Senate Bill 928 overregulates product labels. By law, we're required to read and follow labels of the chemicals we apply. Adding the word neonicotinoid to a container does not provide any additional clarification, instruction, or guidance to the applicator on how best to use the chemical. You heard Scott talk about the bee advisory box that I think is a useful tool in providing specific guidelines. Northwest retailers have already communicated consumer concerns to growers like myself, and we have transitioned to neonicotinoid-free production, not because the government regulated it, but because consumers demanded it. And you heard Lori speak to that earlier. And I think good labeling provides clarity for customers. I'm not sure that putting neonicotinoid-free signifies anything other than you didn't use that chemical, but it doesn't say whether you used an organophosphate in its place. So I'm not sure that that's providing the type of clarity you're looking for. My concern on Senate Bill 929 is that you are effectively doing a vote of no confidence. This bill sets a dangerous precedent of stepping outside of our current system of studying, classifying, and regulating chemical usage. ODA and EPA employ technical staff with specific education in entomology or biology. The current system balances human and environmental impacts and meets consumer demands for quality and public health safety. They require all chemicals to have labels with specific directives for application methods and rates. Circumventing the current system is inappropriate and only serves to erode any confidence or authority that is invested in the Oregon Department of Agriculture to act on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Chair Dembrow and committee. My name is Josh Zielinski. I'm a fifth-generation farmer and nurseryman at Alpha Nursery, which is not too far from here in Northeast Salem. We grow a wide array of ornamental plants, and we ship across, much like most other Oregon nurseries, we ship about 80% of our product out of the state. We also farm, and on our farm we grow several specialty seed crops which require the use of bees for pollination. So bees and pollinator health is extremely important to me, but for various reasons I oppose both of the bills being proposed today, 928 and 929. Many of the labeling concerns I had were expressed better than I could say them by Lee. But I also agree with the previous farmer who mentioned that they would be costly and burdensome. In a similar situation, I don't know when I'm ordering labels where my plants are going, if it's not required in Idaho, I might not want to label a plant as such. Lee's also touched on the fact that the ODA and its personnel of well-qualified biologists, entomologists, botanists, etc., already has the authority to make the decision to move pesticides to a restricted use. And the EPA has, on a federal level, has continually reviewed this class of pesticide for the last several years. In many cases, this class is preferred to other methods of pest mitigation, as it is relatively safe to humans, the environment, and pollinators, especially when compared to much harsher and more frequently applied predecessor chemicals. Applicators need to follow the law and follow the label. And let's see. I would also say that most nurseries are going to only apply them as needed. It's not like it's cheap and we just run around spraying this stuff all over. As a part of our integrated pest management, we cannot sell plants that don't meet certain quality standards. One of those quality standards is that they be pest free. With that said, I would encourage you to come out and visit a nursery, see what's going on, how these are applied, where they are applied. As Lee said, many of these nurseries are no longer using them and have reverted to other methods. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Josh. Roger.
Yes, Chair Dembo and committee, my name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Blueberry Commission. The blueberry producers need all the tools available to them to control spotted wing Drosophila and other pests that they have to deal with on a daily basis. Neonics are just one of the tools, and they are actually a lot more selective than some of the other alternatives. To single them out under a labeling requirement makes no sense. And I'm here in opposition to 928. Labeling requirement in this bill would mislead the public because there is no requirement that the fresh fruit contain any residue before a label is required. Also, packers receive fruit from multiple growers. Those growers often have multiple fields, and they don't treat all the fields the same. They treat them as they are needed to manage the pests that are in each individual field. This bill would create a logistical and regulatory nightmare for both the packers and the producers. And finally, this bill would disadvantage Oregon growers because it would end up having to label all of our fruit because, like, as you've heard from other producers, you don't know where your fruit's going to go when it's going to the packing shed. So out-of-state growers would only have to label fruit coming into Oregon, yet Oregon producers would have to label all their fruit, and it would sort of put them at a disadvantage. With that, I urge a no vote on Senate Bill 928.
Thank you, Richard. Jenny.
Perfect, yep. Chair Dembro, committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are the state's largest general ag association, representing 7,000 farming and ranching families statewide. We represent growers of over 220 different commodities, including the beekeepers. So today we are here to share that we support the goal, of supporting pollinators. We are supporting two bills this session, House Bill 2535 and Senate Bill 814, which really address the habitat issues and the malnutrition issues that we've seen in recent years. For the committee's record as well, there's been a lot of talk about Veroamite, and this topic came up in the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources, and we had the opportunity to have OSU Extension there at that point, who discussed the incredible mortality this year due to Veroamite and the overwintering loss. And we're looking at over 30% right now for our beekeepers, so very significant hit, something that we're trying to help them work through and make sure that they've got the tools that they need to make those operations successful. So we are here today, obviously sharing that the support of pollinators, insect pollination is incredibly important to Oregon agriculture, for pollinating a lot of tree fruits and blueberries, as you heard, but also for a lot of the seed crops that we grow, so for cabbage and mustard and broccoli, very important component. At the same time, farmers in Oregon depend on pesticides to help produce their crops efficiently and economically. And with that, Oregon Farm Bureau echoes the previous comments and the previous concerns that our partners in the ag community have expressed. Specifically with regard to Senate Bill 928, our concern is that neonic labeling doesn't provide meaningful information to consumers. You've heard that comment expressed. The label has nothing to do with whether or not there's a residue on the product, and we're afraid that it would scare consumers and create a fear-based situation that we don't necessarily need to be creating in this instance. Further, we've got some concerns that Senate Bill 928 is compelled speech. It essentially mandates a label and a speech that is not based necessarily on a human health criteria. So concern there. Another one that you heard from the farmer Bill Case and from the Blueberry Commission is around Oregon's position in the marketplace. So we export 80% of the goods that we produce. We're looking to sell both internationally and domestically, and we're afraid that an Oregon-specific label jeopardizes that position in the marketplace. Senate Bill 929, you heard several concerns there. I've got 21 seconds left. I wanted to speak to a technical issue with the bill. There's an exemption for domestic pets, but there isn't one for livestock producers. So for us, imidacloprid is a neonicotinoid, and it's used on cattle and sheep as a pour-on for lice and horn flies. If you had an applicator's license as a farmer, you may be able to use those products, but as a 4-H or FFA student, you wouldn't be able to. So that's a technical issue that we're seeing with regard to some animal health issues. I think since my time ran out, I appreciate the opportunity to comment today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jenny. And thanks for reminding us of Senate Bill 814. That's one we'll probably have a hearing on. I see I'm a sponsor of it. So. Anyway, okay. Thank you all. So is there anyone here who is under the age of 10 who would like to testify?
Yes.
Great. That's in human years.
My name is Alice, and the bees are special, and they pollinate our food.
Okay, so if you could speak as loud as you can, Alice.
The bees are special.
And what else do they do?
Pollinate our food.
And what would happen if they were gone?
Then we wouldn't have any more food.
And that wouldn't be very nice, would it?
Yes. And Mom, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes. Good evening. My name is Misty, and I'm Alice's mother. And I grew up during the summers here in Oregon and enjoyed very much the greenery and the natural beauty of Oregon. I was terrified of bees, what I thought were bees when I was a child. And so now I have an opportunity to educate my daughter on how special they are. We're asking that we put neonicotinoids in the class with 500 other chemicals that are restricted. We're not asking that farmers give up anything. They already have access to these chemicals. For the first time, bees are on the endangered species list, and that concerns me greatly. And what kind of future will my daughter have? It breaks my heart to look into my beautiful daughter's eyes and imagine a world that I don't want to imagine a world without bees. And what she is facing, what her generation is facing, it's unforgivable. And it's heartbreaking, and the petrochemical companies have had their day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Misty, and thank you. Thank you for bringing Alice, and Alice, thank you for coming. Okay, so friends, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to bring this to a close. I know many of you have submitted written testimony. If you have not and you didn't get a chance to speak and would like to, please feel free to. Send it in to us here at the committee, and we'll post it. There is a lot of material online that has been submitted. I encourage you to check it out. You may not agree with all of it, but there's a lot of meat there. I want to thank you all for what was, I believe, a very rich hearing. Okay, by the end of this week. Okay. So with that, everyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 928 and 929, and we are adjourned. And we are adjourned.